Sache. Okay, so let's continue. So my watch says 6:25 plus 45 minutes. That's 10 past 7. Okay. So now we can take advantage of our effort to understand this Dirac analysis, because now we will apply this formalism to general relativity. So we consider the canonical formulation. Of GR, and I will actually only treat the vacuum case here. So just vacuum. Otherwise, I mean, matter can be also formulated, but it will make my life more complicated. And anyway, I will just want to try to give you the ideas. So our action is the Einstein-Hilbert action, 1/16 πg. G is the Newton constant. M d4x square root of determinant of G, four-dimensional curvature scalar. And let me make my life even more simple. One thing that I will assume is the following. M is topologically the same as the real line times a three-dimensional manifold, and I will assume that the boundary, there's no boundary. This just in order to make my life a little bit simpler. This M takes this form is dictated by the requirement to have a well-defined initial value formulation. So you give some initial data on some hypersurface, and you want that the evolution of this this initial data by the Einstein equations produces a causal space-time. So initial data coming from some region here should have influence only within its light cone to what happens in here. So this is called global hyperbolicity. And by a theorem due to Guerosch, it has the implication that topologically M should take this form. Now what we want to do is to perform our Dirac analysis. So we have to introduce configuration coordinates and momentum coordinates. So we have to perform the Legendre transformation. And the framework for doing this has been found by ADM, Arnowitt, Deser, and Miesner. You can find the details about this, for example, in Wall's book. But I will sketch it for you here. So we, by assumption, we have the following situation. So this is our space-time manifold, this box. And by assumption, I can foliate this space-time manifold into three-dimensional surfaces. So I can introduce coordinates t and xa. A runs from 1 to 3. And I have my space-time coordinates x mu. And I can, what this means is that there's a diffeomorphism from the x mu's to the little t and x, a. Right, and the images of this three-dimensional manifold under these embeddings, one parameter family of embeddings, so xt of sigma is just the set of all the xt of xa, where xa is in sigma. I call this capital sigma t. So these are parameterized by this t parameter, while sigma, the little sigma, is independent of that. So just to distinguish the four-dimensional situation from the intrinsic three-dimensional situation. So this defines a foliation of M into hypersurfaces. So here are a couple of them, sigma T1, sigma T2, sigma T3. And you can now ask what happens if I go from one hypersurface to the next without changing the small axis. So I may land here somewhere. So that means that I'm looking at dx mu by dt because I'm not changing the axis, the small axis. If I have a metric, if we have our metric on this manifold, then this vector field will decompose into a normal piece and a tangential piece. And orthogonal means, of course, with respect to the metric here. So let me call this by n mu. And this is fat dot x mu. And n mu. Well, you can not see this anymore, but I will write it there. So this decomposes into a normal and a tangential piece, n and mu plus n mu, and n mu can be written as n a x mu comma a. X mu comma a is equal to x mu by dx a is a tangential vector field. So I can always decompose n mu like this. And these coefficients here, n is called the Laplace function. And n a is called the shift vector field. OK, now what I will do is I write the line element ds squared g mu nu dx nu, and I pull it back to these coordinates here, to these ADM coordinates. Then I pick up the following terms, g mu nu x dot mu dt plus x mu comma a dx a times x dot nu dt plus x nu comma b dx b. And you end up with minus n squared plus qab n a and b dt squared plus qab n b 2 times dt dx a plus QAB DXA DXB. And this important function QAB here, maybe I should write it because it's so important on a separate blackboard. QAB equal to g mu nu x mu comma a x nu comma b. this is called, well, it's the pullback under the embeddings of the four-dimensional metric to this little hypersurface, to this hypersurface sigma, to this t-independent one. And this is called the intrinsic metric. So and this will be our configuration coordinate. And notice that these are, of course, tensor fields. So it's QAB is a function of T and X. So now we need to consider momentum variables. Or first of all, velocities. So QAB can be seen also as the pullback under the following object. Q mu nu is the same as, this is the four-dimensional way of writing this thing, plus n mu and nu. And I forgot to tell you, of course, that I'm making the assumption that n mu is normalized. So n mu is equal to minus 1. So here you see that we are dealing with Lorentzian metrics. And also, it follows from the construction that n mu x mu comma a is equal to 0. This you actually need in order to get from here to here. So you can also see immediately that qab is q mu nu x mu comma a x nu comma b. Now we define a second tensor field. K mu nu equal to Q mu rho Q nu sigma nabla rho n sigma. And nabla is the unique torsion-free G compatible covariant differential. So it kills the metric and is torsion free. And then we can also define KAB. So you see this metric Q mu nu has the property that Q mu nu and nu is equal to 0 because n is normalized to minus 1. And therefore, this tensor field is a kind of projector to spatial tensor fields. So since it's spatial, I can also, without loss of generality, just consider its pull-backed components. I don't lose any information. K mu nu. And thus, you can now write in terms of Laplace function, shift vector fields, and this configuration three metric in the following form, 1 over 2n qab dot minus ln qab. And this is the Lie derivative of q with respect to n vector. Without projecting, it's not symmetric. Without projecting, it is not symmetric.
It's not symmetric.
Yeah.
Okay.
Excuse me, what is the relation between the first equation on the left board and the second equation on the right board?
This one?
Yes, because here we have g mu and derivative, and here is q.
There's no relation between q and k. I'm just considering a second tensor field. And it knows about the covariant or the parallel transport of this vector field orthogonal to the hypersurfaces. And this tensor field is called the extrinsic curvature. Because if it would vanish, then it would mean that the vector field is parallel transported along the hypersurface. So it means that as it is embedded into this space-time manifold, it doesn't curve. But if it's non-vanishing, there's some curvature, and that's why it's called the extrinsic curvature of sigma. And now the important point is to realize that QAB is a configuration variable, but this tensor field contains information about its velocities, so the QAB dot. So I should maybe call this, well, this, maybe I should call it VAB to make it obvious that this is a kind of velocity, but this is unfortunately the standard notation that you will find in the textbooks. So now we are ready to almost ready to define our Legendre transformation. Just we need one more thing. We need to write the Einstein-Hilbert action in terms of these variables. And one can show, and this is a very nice differential geometric identity. It's called the Gauss-Kodachi equation. I'm never sure whether you should write this with double Z or double C. Maybe Carlo knows.
We had a discussion yesterday.
Okay. So which says that you can write the four-dimensional curvature as the three-dimensional curvature. So this is of G, this is of Q, plus KAB, KAB minus K. AB, QAB squared. And here, all the indices AB, C, and so on, which take values 1, 2, 3, they are pulled with Q, with the 3 metric. So you pull this with this. And also, you show that determinant of G can be written as n times determinant of q square root. This is actually not true. There's a derivative term. There's a total derivative term which one has to take in principle care of, and one can, but let me just not do it. Otherwise, my discussion becomes more complicated. In any way, if you impose certain boundary conditions, then this boundary term vanishes. OK, so having made this assumption, we can now perform the Legendre transformation. So I need P, which is delta S by delta N dot P A delta S by delta N A dot and I need P A B equal to delta S by delta Q A B dot. Okay, now.
Can you remind me this one? This is part of the
There's no difference between fat and not fat. But yesterday somebody said that you can't see this dot, for example, you can't see from up there. Okay. So, and the Einstein-Hilbert action is 1 over 16 pi g times in these coordinates r dt d3x n root q times what is written here, r3 plus trace k squared minus trace k squared. So now all we have to do is to perform this functional derivatives. And it's immediately obvious that there is no term here which contains n dot, right? Because what do we have? We have the three-dimensional curvature. It only contains derivatives of QIB, but they're only spatial derivatives. Then there's a term which is quadratic in the case, but the k doesn't contain n dot, and it also doesn't contain time derivatives with respect to the shift vector field. And there's another appearance of n, but it's also not a time derivative. So this is equal to 0. The same is true for na dot. That also doesn't appear in the action at all. And these are our primary constraints. And this one is non-vanishing, and it's not very difficult to see that it's equal to square root of that q times 1 over 16 pi g times kab minus kqab. And k is equal to qab kb. So we see that we encounter here immediately an example for a theory where constraints appear.
Are the indices in this PAB
okay? You're right. Yeah, you're right. Thank you. Okay, now, so we see that we have these primary constraints. Now we have to define the Hamiltonian, which was defined as H is equal to, Q dot AB, PAB plus N dot P plus N dot APA, and the other way around, PA. Minus the Lagrangian. So what is the Lagrangian? The Lagrangian is what's written here. One over 16 pi g times r3 plus kb minus k squared times n and root q is the Lagrangian. And then what you now do, of course, and this has to be evaluated at the solution of after solving the velocities for momenta, we see immediately that we cannot solve n dot and n dot a in terms of p and pa, but we can solve, we can indeed solve q dot ab in terms of pab. And if you do that, then you find that how should I write it? Q dot AB is a certain function UAB of Q and P, and using these formulas you can work it out what it is, and you find N divided by 16 pi G times 1 over determinant of Q square root PAB minus 1 half P squared minus square root of that Q R3 plus the other terms that you cannot resolve. So let me call this lambda in this lambda A. So lambda P plus lambda A PA. Or actually, yesterday I think I called it V. So let me call it V and VA. Okay, so far so good. Now we have to worry about whether the system is consistent. So we have the constraints P equal to 0 and PA equal to 0. So is this constraint surface, is it stable under the time evolution? So we have to compute P dot, which is equal to the Poisson bracket between, this is one important point. This is actually the Hamiltonian density. So the Hamiltonian itself, which I maybe should write like this, is the spatial integral over this d3x, d3x times h of x. So p dot is capital H with P. And now let me just say how you compute this Poisson brackets. If you have two functions f and g, then this is the integral over sigma d3x delta f by delta PAB of x delta g by delta QAB of x. These are functional derivatives minus f and g interchanged. So now you can compute this. So what this turns out to be, I should, of course, write all the other terms as well. So plus delta f by delta p of x, delta g by delta n of x, plus delta f by delta p a of x, delta g by delta n a of x, minus f and g interchanged. So this means, when you look at this, is that we have to compute the functional derivative of h with respect to n of x. Okay, and where's our Hamiltonian? Here it is. The only appearance of n is in this term. Where is it? Here. So we get 1 over 16 pi g times, I don't want to write this again. Let me just call this curly bracket here C. C of x. and I forgot to write one more term here. Very important. Plus NA times minus 2 times dBPBA. And this is the covariant derivative compatible with Q. Say it again.
So you have VA and NA, which I think are the same thing.
No, VA is NA dot.
The function U depends on NA too.
It depends, right, thank you. It depends on N and N vector. Right. And so maybe I should write this here, because you can't see it otherwise. I will call it CA to be this thing there, minus 2 times dB PBA. So now we have derived the equation for P dot. Now we derive the equation for PA dot. PA dot is equal to, well, we have to look for the appearance of NA in this whole thing. And the only appearance of NA is in this term. So we get H, PA of x is equal to, CA of x. So we see that P dot doesn't automatically vanish, and also PA dot doesn't automatically vanish. So we get secondary constraints. And now, this we are not done yet. I mean, we have to. So this was the first step in the algorithm. Now we have to add these constraints to the to these two constraints, and run again through the exercise. And in principle, it might be possible that you might find more and more constraints. But we are lucky, and the formal the algorithm stops at this point, because you can show the following thing: that F and FA be some smooth functions, and C of F be the integral over sigma of these of C of X. Then you can show that the following holds. it was written here
so
before.
It's still Q.
Yeah, it's the same Poisson bracket. I mean, the Poisson bracket is the same as before. Like in classical mechanics, you have df by dq minus times dg by dp.
So that means that f are functions of q too.
No, these are just functions on sigma. They are not dependent on q and p. They have the same meaning like Laplace function and shift vector field. They are just some functions on this manifold sigma. They don't depend on q and p. So, okay, let me write this more explicitly also as so there are several important, by the way, this is called sometimes the Dirac algebra of constraints. And there are some observations now that we can make. First of all, these secondary constraints, they are obviously close among themselves. So the Poisson bracket of all secondary constraints among themselves reproduces on the right-hand side something that which is, again, proportional to a secondary constraint. Next, since these functions only depend on QAB and PAB, but not on Laplace and shift functions anymore, it follows immediately that secondary and first and primary constraints have vanishing Poisson brackets among each other. And there, from these two observations, it follows that H with any constraint is equal to a constraint again. So we are done. The algorithm stops, and we have discovered the full set of all constraints. But now we see something very strange happening, namely the Hamiltonian can be written as V times P plus VA PA plus N times C plus NA times CA, right? So this means that the Hamiltonian is constrained to vanish. So that looks very unusual. I mean, we are usually used to the fact that Hamiltonians are not vanishing. I mean, you want to compute the energy of system, and you're not only interested in zero energy configurations, but here it's happening that this Hamiltonian is constrained to vanish. And this has to do with the fact that the system that we started from, general relativity, is a system with many symmetries, namely the diffeomorphism symmetry of the Einstein-Hilbert action. And this symmetry says that you are only interested in things that are invariant under arbitrary coordinate transformations, in particular under time diffeomorphisms. And this thing actually does generate, among other things, time diffeomorphisms. So when you have a generator which generates gauge transformations rather than symmetries, it means that this generator has to vanish. This is a general fact in constrained system theory due to diffeomorphism invariants. In fact, one can show the following thing. C of F, comma, let's say, for example, let's take Q mu nu of X is Li N Q mu nu, and C of F times Q mu of X is L N N Q mu nu. So these functions, these smeared functions, generate spatial diffeomorphisms. For example, on the three metric, you couldn't put actually any function on the phase space here, not only the three metric. But here it becomes particularly nice. This constraint here generates diffeomorphisms in the time-like direction. No, there's an n. There's a vector error.
In the second line. On the left, you have f on the right.
Yeah, left
on
the left right
side. Oh, I see. Yeah, that's right. Okay. So there should be f vector here and f here.
Probably the same on the left. Also, the other black corner. The last line.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, sorry. Thank you. So the constraints, and in particular, the Hamiltonian, generate diff M, four-dimensional diffeomorphisms. Gauge transformations. Okay, the last thing that I want to say is now that all of this has serious implications for the interpretation of the theory, namely, since these are gauge transformations, it means that Q mu nu or anything else that I have wrote so far is not an observable quantity, because observable quantities should have vanishing Poisson brackets with the constraints. But since the Hamiltonian is a linear combination of constraints, it means that for observable quantities, there's no time evolution. Nothing moves in general relativity. So that is sometimes called the problem of time. And the, one of the virtues of this relational formalism is that it produces for you Dirac observables, things that do have vanishing Poisson brackets with the constraints, but still have another kind of time evolution with respect to these tau parameters that I defined, which are defined, which are generated not by constraints, but by these functions h mu. So if you wanted, you could define a different set of constraints, which are c prime, which is some kind of well, p plus h, and c prime a, which is pa plus h a, with respect to some sort of, well, you decompose qab and pab into, let's say, some capital Q and pi, capital QA and pi A, and some other stuff, HAB, PAB, and P and PA are these two momentum functions here. And you could write the constraints in this form, and then you would discover that this thing does generate physical time evolution. And this is not constrained to vanish. What is constrained to vanish is this. So this relational formalism overcomes this interpretational problem that in general relativity, nothing that is observable seems to move at all. And by the way, this HAB here is symmetric transverse and traceless. So it has only two independent components. And these, in a linearized situation, would be your two propagating degrees of freedom that are sitting in a gravitational wave, at least in vacuum. So I'll stop here. Thank you.